Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to give you a real shortcut into the mind and, well, the art of Theodore Jericho, an artist who packed just an incredible amount of intensity into only 15 years.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We're going to deep into the sources, the biography, the criticism, the social history, everything that fueled his really short but incredibly dramatic career.
Sure, Cole, right. 1791 to 1824. I mean, if you're looking for the absolute definition of the tragic romantic genius, he's pretty much the prototype.
33 years old, that's it.
Barely. And in that decade and a half of actual work, he essentially launches the romantic movement in France. He just rejects neoclassicism, you know, all that focus on idealized reason and perfect order.
And replaces it with?
With raw, often painful, sometimes really shocking human emotion. Individualism, the power of the natural world, or maybe more accurately, the uncontrolled world. That's what he was after.
And he wasn't interested in, like, safe commissioned work. His paintings often dealt with the defeated, the politically explosive, the totally marginalized, which is kind of fascinating given his own background.
Exactly. And you see that dramatic archetype playing out in his life, too. There's this brooding, intense persona you glimpse in his self-portraits. There's the long illness that haunted his last years. And, of course, that disastrous, passionate love affair.
So our goal for you today is really to unpack how Jericho, despite this brief, pretty turbulent life, didn't just paint differently. He fundamentally challenged what subjects were even considered worthy of art.
Right. He tore down traditions, societal prejudices, things that, honestly, we're still talking about today in different ways.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. His origins, and maybe his first big obsession, horses. He was born in Rouen in 1791, son of a successful lawyer. Seems like he was a restless kid, very independent right from the start.
Oh, absolutely. And horses dominated his early life, sketching them constantly. Then his mother died, and at 17, he inherits the substantial fortune.
Which was crucial, you said.
It was huge. That money wasn't just security. It gave him the independence he needed to basically tell the artistic establishment where to go.
And he did. He trained initially under Carl Vernet, who was famous for equestrian scenes, but apparently against his father's wishes.
Yeah, and that didn't last long. Vernet represented that very conventional, polished style of horse painting.
And there's that famous story, right?
The classic clash. Vernet apparently suggested Jericho's horses were too spirited, too much life in them.
And Jericho's reply.
He just shoots back, "One of my horses would have devoured six of his." It perfectly sums up his impatience with anything lacking, well, fire, vitality.
So he dropped the formal training.
Pretty much. Took his money and taught himself, basically. Spent hours at the Louvre, studying the dynamism of Rubens, the anatomical power of Michelangelo. He built his own education.
And it happened incredibly fast. 1812, he's only 21, and he has his breakthrough piece, The Charging Chasseur. Wins a gold medal at the Salon.
Yeah, which is remarkable.
On the surface, it looks conventional enough. Napoleonic officer, rearing horse, victory. But you're saying even here, he was doing something different.
Subtly, yes. The whole composition is built around the horse's explosive movement. And look at the officer. He's not staring heroically into battle. He's gazing off kind of into the distance, into some uncertain space.
Hmm. Like the glory already has a shadow over it.
Exactly. There's already a hint of melancholy there.
And that hint just explodes 2 years later, doesn't it? You go from the chasseur in 1812 straight to the wounded cuirassier leaving the battle in 1814. That's a sharp turn.
It's incredibly deliberate, a huge pivot from celebrating the warrior to mourning defeat in just 2 years.
And this is where he really breaks from that neoclassical tradition of state-sponsored art.
Fundamentally, it was partly reflecting reality, of course. By 1814, Napoleon's empire was crumbling, defeat was in the air, but it was also a massive artistic statement. Instead of another glorious win, Jericho shows this lone, totally exhausted soldier retreating.
And the way he paints it emphasizes the despair.
Absolutely. The soldier's sword, you know, his symbol of power, he's using it like a crutch, just to hold himself up. Critics hated it. They found the subject, a defeated soldier, unappealing. Art was supposed to elevate, right? Not show failure.
But it is a key work.
Oh, pivotal. It's like a requiem for the whole Napoleonic era. And a definitive step towards romantic realism, where artistic truth, even ugly truth, matters more than nationalistic heroism. You even see this realism in his studies, like the head of a horse from around 1815. The use of light and shadow there, it conveys such nobility, such emotion.
Okay, let's shift to his personal life, because the period between 1816 and 1818 seems like pure chaos, and it sets the stage for his absolute masterpiece.
It really does. First, he fails twice to win the Prix de Rome.
which was a huge deal back then, right? The state scholarship to study in Rome kind of cemented your career.
Exactly. So that failure, plus maybe losing his mother's stabilizing influence earlier, he decides to go to Italy anyway, using his own money.
Yeah.
And that's where his personal life just completely implodes.
This is the affair.
Yes. A disastrous period. While he's in Italy, he starts an affair with Alexandrine Modeste Carola de Saint-Martin.
Who was?
His uncle's wife. And 8 years older than him.
Oh, wow.
The fallout was immediate and immense. The affair resulted in a son, Joris Hippolyte, born in 1818.
And the uncle, who had been supporting him?
Cut him off completely. Understandably, maybe.
Yeah.
But that rejection, the social scandal, the sheer emotional weight of it all. Jericho reportedly never saw Alexandrine or his son again. It must have been suffocating.
A private catastrophe.
Which seems to have fueled a very public confrontation in his art.
Yeah.
You see some of that private intensity maybe in a work like Three Lovers from around this time. It's his only known erotic painting, and it captures sexuality with this directness, this energy that just ignores all the classical ideals.
So the fire he was suppressing personally gets channeled somewhere else.
Immediately. Yeah. Into a public scandal, basically as soon as he gets back to Paris.
Which brings us to the Raft of the Medusa, 1819. Not commissioned, absolutely enormous, 16 by 24 feet.
Smash.
And it's considered the seminal work of French Romanticism. Why? Because he takes the heroic scale, the grand style, usually reserved for noble history painting.
And applies it to this horrific recent disaster involving ordinary suffering people. Victims, not heroes.
And the story behind it is just unbelievable.
It's pure nightmare fuel. The French naval ship, the Medusa, wrecked off Africa in 1816. And the reason? The captain was grossly incompetent.
How did he get the job?
Political connections. He was appointed by the newly restored Bourbon monarchy. When the ship started sinking, the captain and his officers took the lifeboats.
And abandoned 147 crew members and soldiers on a makeshift raft.
Left them to drift. For 13 days, only 15 survived. And they survived through cannibalism and murder.
And Jericho didn't sanitize this at all.
No way. He immersed himself in it. He interviewed the survivors. He had carpenters build a scale model of the raft in his studio. He went to morgues.
I read he studied corpses, severed limbs.
He did. To capture the look of decay, of suffering, with absolute accuracy. The political dimension here was just explosive. Jericho wasn't just painting a shipwreck. He was showing the direct, horrific consequences of the Bourbon regime's corruption and incompetence.
The captain's failure reflected badly on the whole government.
Exactly. Which explains why it got such mixed, politically charged reviews in Paris. People knew what he was saying.
But it was a huge hit when he took it to London.
Massive. 50,000 people paid to see it. It completely bypassed the French political sensitivities of the Salon. Commercial success.
Speaking of London, that success led him to spend time in England, 1820 to 21. And beyond being influenced by things like English sporting prints, which led to the Epsom Downs Derby.
Right, with the famous Flying Gallop horses, which we now know from photos is anatomically impossible, but it looked dynamic.
Right, but beyond that, it seems like his shift towards social commentary really defined this period in London.
That's the crucial thing. Jericho became fascinated by the turbulent reality of modern urban life. He was deeply affected by the poverty, the destitution he saw in London.
So his lithographs from this time, the English series.
They focus on the working class, the marginalized, not famous landmarks or the fashionable elite. Think of prints like Pity the Sorrows of a Poor Old Man. It's almost like documentary work, capturing industrial suffering.
And he also stayed near Cato Street.
Yeah.
And drew the execution.
Yes, the drawing Le Supplice.
Yeah.
It depicts the public execution of the Cato Street conspirators they'd plotted to murder the entire British cabinet in 1820.
So this is an abstract realism. He's focusing on the brutality of the state, the legal system.
Exactly. He keeps gravitating towards suffering that's sanctioned by the state, whether it's the political fallout from the Medusa or a public execution. He shows the condemned men in these final, awful moments. He forces the viewer to confront these really unpleasant truths directly.
That profound focus on human suffering, especially maybe state-inflicted suffering, brings us to probably the most pioneering and definitely the most unique part of his legacy.
The Portraits of the Insane.
The series of 10 portraits of insane patients painted between 1821 and 1823. And there's a personal context here too, right? He was dealing with financial problems. He had a family history of mental illness.
And he'd had something of a nervous breakdown himself after the sheer intensity of finishing the Medusa. So yes, there was a personal resonance.
And this project was commissioned by a psychiatrist.
Yes, Dr. Etienne Jean-Georget, and the idea was medically and artistically radical for the time. Georget wanted illustrations of different forms of what they then called monomania, basically, an obsessive fixation on a single idea or object.
To educate people.
Partly, yes, and to correct what Georget called popular misconceptions of the insane. Because the typical artistic portrayal of madness back then
was grotesque caricature, right, or sometimes romanticized genius.
Precisely. Either mocked or mythologized. Géricault rejected both completely. He depicted these individuals with incredible dignity and intense realism. It was a groundbreaking attempt to humanize them, to challenge society's deep-seated prejudices.
And he pursued this with his usual intensity, observing patients in asylums.
And again, reportedly studying the faces of guillotine victims to understand the nuances of extreme psychological distress. He wanted clinical accuracy, but filtered through his empathetic gaze.
We only have 5 of the 10 portraits left, but they are just incredibly powerful. Take the woman suffering from obsessive envy, sometimes called the hyena of Salpêtrière.
Look closely at her face. It's pale, tight. The mouth is tense. The eyes are downcast, red-rimmed. It conveys this immense internal suffering.
Not theatrical madness.
Not at all. She isn't gesturing wildly. She's contained, which somehow suggests this deep inner turmoil, maybe the potential for a sudden outburst, but it's all held inside.
And then there's the man with delusions of military command. He's got this improvised medal, this melancholic, almost bewildered look.
And this portrait, I think, really goes beyond just being a clinical illustration. Yes, it depicts a specific delusion, but many scholars see it reflecting that widespread post-Napoleonic disillusionment across France.
Ah, so the man's fixation on military glory connects to the whole nation's loss of glory.
It's quite possible. Géricault uses this one individual, maybe, to reflect a broader societal grief. The psychological insight is just immense. And apparently, he often achieved these in single, intense sittings.
So Géricault's 15-year career, terribly brief, but the impact is staggering. He reinvents military painting, defines political controversy with Medusa, pioneers psychiatric art.
And even as his health was failing rapidly, he had a tubercular infection of the spine. Made worse by writing accidents, he was still planning huge, ambitious paintings.
He died in January 1824, just 33.
Yeah. And while his life fits that romantic myth perfectly, the tormented genius burning out too fast, his legacy isn't just about passion. It was absolutely rooted in immense technical skill, hard work, sheer expertise.
It wasn't just feeling, it was craft.
Totally. And his willingness to confront the ugliness, the pain, the complexity of human existence that paved the way for everyone who came after in French art, most obviously, Eugène Delacroix.
And that commitment, that sympathy, it lasted right to the end. You mentioned one of his last pieces, The Portrait of a Child with a Dog, Little Oliver Bro.
It's an incredibly poignant piece. The boy is only 5, but he has this serious, almost adult expression. He's next to a dog, but also a military saber.
And the context is political again.
Deeply. Oliver's father, Colonel Louis Bro, was a loyal Bonapartist. After Waterloo, he was dismissed, spied on by the royalist government. Géricault uses this portrait of an innocent child to talk about the seriousness of war, the persecution faced by people like Bro. It was a gesture of friendship, rooted in this shared sort of socio-political despair.
Highlighting the personal cost of politics.
Always the personal cost. And speaking of personal lies, Géricault left his estate to his father, who then did something quite remarkable.
He passed the inheritance on.
Yes, to Géricault's illegitimate son, Georges Hippolyte, who was only 5 at the time. Honoring Géricault's complicated private life after his death. A complicated, passionate, fleeting life that really did change art history.
Which brings us to our final thought for you. Based on the sources around those groundbreaking portraits of the insane, when you look at that sympathetic, incredibly realistic portrait, the one of the woman suffering from obsessive envy.
An emotion most people feel at some point.
Exactly. Géricault's sources really push us to ask, where is the boundary? When does a common, powerful feeling like envy or jealousy cross that fragile line and get labeled as a medical monomania, something that justifies locking someone away?
Géricault forces you, the viewer, to look past the label insane and see the individual human struggling with intense, recognizable emotion. He makes you question how rigidly we define and marginalize people based on those categories. It's a question that still feels relevant.
Something to think about. Thank you for diving deep with us today. We'll see you next time.